Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, welcome. Well, I want to thank you for being with us today. I have to fess up, I'm not here in person. I'm there in spirit today, but not in person. I had a very last minute field assignment, and so I'm out in the field right now as you're listening. I hope it's raining. I hope it's not raining. Otherwise, I'm going to be very wet and soggy while you're listening to this. But today we're bringing you two new interviews that I pre-recorded last week. I want to say a huge thank you to Eric Ryder for putting these interviews together and bringing them to you on today's show. So thank you, Eric. I really do appreciate you jumping in there. My second guest today, let me tell you about him. His name is Dr. Earl Henslin. He's examined over his career more than 50,000 brain scans and has come up with some really interesting and amazing information about our brain in love. He says when it comes to love, guess what? Size does matter. He also says that being in love affects the brain like cocaine, and that a good sex life is truly one of the best prescriptions for a good, healthy heart. So stay tuned. Dr. Henslin is coming up around 12:30 today. But first, if you've ever felt like screaming, stop the world, I need to get off for a minute, or, you know, while I catch my breath, while I regroup, while I get organized, then Jennifer Ford-Berry has some great tips for decluttering our lives so that we do have more free time and can actually get outside and play once in a while. Again, I talked with her earlier this month, and here's that interview for the first time. Jennifer Ford-Berry is a professional organizer, entrepreneur, speaker, and author. In 2002, she founded Organize This, a professional organizing business. She's the author of Organize Now and has written articles and ebooks, including weekly organizing tips. And she's joining us today to tell us how we can get a fresh start early in 2010, how we can get organized for the year ahead. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Vicki. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. I'm one of those people who likes to be really, really organized. And I know for some people it comes fairly easily. You said yourself you find it pretty organic for you. But I want to just go back and share a little bit with our listeners, because you used to work, I read, for the British Embassy, used to work for the World Bank. Then you had your first child and things changed. Tell us how you got into professional organizing.
Well, it's funny because I had my daughter pretty shortly after 9/11, and I was on maternity leave, and after 3 months, I went back to corporate America, and about 2 months later, I was laid off, which was a lot of the same story for many Americans, and I was actually excited about it because I was getting paid to stay home with my baby, and about a few weeks into being laid off, I thought, well, now what am I going to do? And I really, you know, luckily had been on a spiritual path of kind of looking deeper into myself, and I said, you know, what am I passionate about? What can I do that I love? And it would be really nice to not have to go back to corporate America. And what I kept coming up with when I asked myself what I love was organizing. And I had loved it since I was a child, but what I really thought in my mind is there's no way I'm going to make an income doing this.
Right.
I didn't really know there was an industry and there was a professional organizer for a job title, but I just kept coming up with the same thing. So I actually followed my heart and started doing professional organizing in Charlotte, and I came up with a website and a weekly newsletter called Weekly Organizing Tips. And what happened was I was actually starting to write the book without even knowing it.
And this has led to, I mean, you've led to, you have an event that you put on 4 times a year. I saw you've got blogs involved. I mean, it's led to a whole new lifestyle, not just a new career, hasn't it?
Really? It It has been, and you know what? It's awesome because I didn't have to go back to corporate America. I wasn't making as much money for a long time, but really what happened is every day I woke up excited and I was enthusiastic about what I was doing, and I started realizing that the fact that I'm good at organizing actually changes people's lives, mm-hmm. and that just drove me to do it more and more.
It does. Now, I said at the beginning, you know, it comes very naturally to some people. I don't like being disorganized because it wastes time. I get frustrated looking for stuff. And as I'm looking for stuff, I make more mess and I get more disorganized. So one of the reasons I like to be organized is I think it helps eliminate that. But for people who it just doesn't come naturally and, you know, we're all wired differently. Where do you suggest they begin?
Well, the thing is, first of all, clutter affects us in many, many ways, including physically. And what clutter also does is it sucks our energy out, and it makes us feel overwhelmed. It makes us feel a lot of things, but the big thing is overwhelmed. And when you're staring at a lot of cluttered areas of your life, and, you know, let me say that clutter comes in many, many shapes and sizes. It can be debt. It can be the papers piled on the countertop. It can be weight gain. It can be baggage from a different relationship. That's all clutter. And when we have too much of it, we feel overwhelmed, and what happens is we don't know where to begin. And the best place to begin is to pick one specific spot or one specific area of your life, whether it's your schedule or a room in your house, something that's really bothering you. Get it done right. Don't get sidetracked into another area of your life and try to fix that at the same time. Focus on one thing, and after you're done, you'll feel good, you'll feel energized, and you'll be motivated to go to the next area. And that's the way I tell everybody to begin. I also like to use a little paraphrase called LIVE, and it starts with list. There's so many things we want to do, but listing them just gets them off our minds. Then internally organized. So I always say get your mind, your priorities, what you want to accomplish in life. Get very clear about that. And it coincides with the V, which is vision. And, you know, to really take time to see if your life could be anything, what would it look like? What would that snapshot be? Where would you work? Where would you live? What would you do more of? What would you do less of? And then finally, E for external organization.
Okay.
Which means your spaces.
Okay. So let's say that, one of the things you talk about is on your blog, you talk about the top three suggestions for getting organized, which I thought was really good. Try and use what you've already got in the way of storage containers. And I'll tell you why I think this is good, because I have a friend who's keeps saying, I'm going to get my house organized, but I have to go out and get all these containers first. we often put things in our own way, don't we? So look around and find what we've already got. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, it's funny because, you know, the sad words right now are green, and it coincides with organizing. There's actually words out there called green organizing, and what it is the fact that you're not only recycling what you don't want, but you're also using what you already have, so you're not actually bringing in more stuff to the house. You're not buying more and adding that to the clutter. So what it really is, and I always do this with my clients, because they usually have a pen and paper ready and saying, what can I go buy? And I'll say, we're not buying anything until we see what you have. And a lot of times, if you get creative, you can find storage in things that you already have, maybe baskets or, you know, different decorative boxes and things like that. So I think it's really important to start there so you're actually keeping what you already have and using it to store items rather than getting more and more and more.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do you get the family involved if you're living with a family, or how do you get your spouse involved?
Great question.
You know, oftentimes one person is really organized and the other person is not. So how do you get on the same page?
Well, I think first of all, when you're dealing with a shared environment, we have to keep in mind it's a team effort. One person shouldn't be responsible, and we need to ask for help, and we need to be very clear of where, you know, I always say everything needs a home, but it's not going to work if only one person in that environment knows where the homes are. So we want to all know where the homes are, and then we also want to be sharing the responsibility of what needs to be done. A lot of times I like for families to call it a family chore chart or family time management, because it's listing everything that needs to be taken care of, usually in a week's time. And if other people in the household know what needs to be done, they can choose when it's time efficient for them to do it, rather than, you know, one person delegating and saying, do it today at 5 o'clock. Usually, you know, everybody has their own schedule, so when it's convenient for them, they can get it done.
Yeah, and I loved having the chore chart for the kids, because I think, you know, and having the reward at the end of it, I just think that's so valuable, because it helps kids get organized, because when they move out of the home, a lot of kids have problems, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is a topic I'm so passionate about right now. I'm actually doing a ton of research that's the topic of my next book, because I believe that kids need to be taught the skill of organizing, much like being taught how to ride a bike or reading and writing. It's something important that we need to give them so they're efficient, successful adults. And you can start, you know, age of two. You know, a toddler can be taught that the wooden blocks go in the red bin. So it's a gift we give our children, and it's something that will help them be successful in the future.
Now, where do you recommend people start in the house? If the whole house needs organizing, where do you normally start?
I would definitely, if they don't, you know, if they're looking around and everything's cluttered and they don't know where to start, I would start with either the main room of the house, which is usually either the entranceway or the kitchen. And that's where it's hard, because it's coming and going, and a lot of things are being brought into the house and being taken out of the house. So those are the main areas that usually are most important to make the house, you know, function efficiently. After that, I simply say, pick the areas that are bothering you the most, and, you know, get rid of that stress, get rid of that anxiety of looking at that area, and move on from there.
Yeah, that makes sense. It makes sense to start where you come into the house as well, because you come in and you can see a positive change there as well, which has got to make you feel good.
Yes, great point.
Mm-hmm. What about... I've seen that show on TV, Hoarders. Have you been watching that?
Yeah.
It's really scary.
Because it is so interesting. And yeah, it takes it to a whole new dimension.
But that is extreme. But the thing is, I think, even if you're just feeling a little bit overwhelmed, which I'm sure we all go through at times, it really just helps to gather that clutter and get rid of it. And I know I've brought an organizer in because I didn't have time to get to the garage, and I still had boxes in there about a year after I'd moved into the house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it doesn't have to be a severe situation. So tell us, if you, as an organizer, what your approach is when you go to work with somebody. How do you make them feel comfortable?
My approach is to start out and just have a chat, because there's a lot more issues that are important for me to know, such as, why is it hard to maintain this environment? Are you not getting help from your family? Have you inherited loved ones? Previous prized possessions. What's really going on? And then after that, we start one area at a time, and we really work on A, how to clean it up, how to get it organized, and B, how to keep it that way, which is so crucial, because why put the effort and the money into hiring a professional if it's not going to stay that way?
Right. It makes perfect sense. Well, I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to ask you about your 5 trademarks for organizing tips. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Jennifer Ford Berry. She's a professional organizer and the author of Organize Now. Please stay with us.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-333-7000. 457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa.
February 22nd on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, a day in the life of Oscar the Cat. Dr. David Dosa was more than skeptical when he first heard about the resident cat at a nursing home, the cat who regularly predicted a patient's imminent death by snuggling up to them during their last few hours. What does Dr. Dosa think now? Is Oscar the Cat a furry little grim reaper or a comfort to caregivers and patients? Join us Monday the 22nd to find out on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for hundreds of past interviews.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa!
Open your ears, open your heart, open your mind. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back. Welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And we're talking today with Jennifer Ford Berry. She's a professional organizer. And, you know, it feels really good when you've cleaned out the house, when you've got everything where it should be. And that's what we're talking about today. But Jennifer, I wanted to ask you what some of your trademark organizing tips are that you're constantly telling clients. And I know one of them is to create and use only one system for each category of paper or stuff in your life. I wonder if you talk a little bit about that.
Well, let me just be honest here. Paper is everybody's worst nightmare, including myself. And the reason I've come up with the main reason why paper is so troublesome is because it never stops coming into our life. You might organize the living room, and you know no furniture is showing up tomorrow unless you order it. But paper is never-ending, and it's usually, you know, 20% of the paper we get is actually really important. So you want to set up a system that you're actually going to follow through with and something that really works with your lifestyle. So, like I always say, one of my trademarks is every single thing needs a home. And some people don't want to hear that because they're living in the future. They're saying, well, you know, my stuff doesn't have a home here, but in 3 years I'm building a bigger house.
Right.
We have to live in the now, and if everything can't have a home, you have too much stuff. So it's the same with paper. Every piece has to have a home, and also with paper, you want to try to make a decision on that paper as soon as it gets into your house or as close to the time it comes as possible.
Right, right. You say, think like a professional organizer, primary, secondary, tertiary space and stuff, and organize all areas of your home based on that. What do you mean by that?
Well, it comes down to function. So when you're dealing with space, you want to say, what's the function of this room? Don't neglect the obvious, such as the bedroom is for a good night's rest. Because if you're looking at piles and piles of laundry before you go to sleep, chances are it's going to bother you. I had a presentation yesterday, and a lady said, what about the antique dolls that my family gave me are staring at me at night, and I don't even like them? Well, obviously, that doesn't make her feel tranquil and restful. So you really want to look at the function of the room, and you want to be honest with yourself, saying, what do I want to do in this space? And after that, you want to remove everything that doesn't belong. And you want to keep that function in the forefront of your mind, because it will help you decide what homes are best for the things in your life.
Okay, great. And then you say group like things together. Spend 5 or 10 minutes working on clutter rather than fretting about it. How do we group like things together?
Well, you want to make sure, you know, like things, if you're grouping them together, that means they're easier to find, kind of like setting up a category. So it saves time because you come into a space and you're like, okay, this is where all these like items are together. I'll know that. And maybe other people that share your space know that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it just kind of cuts down on wasting time. And it also makes it easier for you to set up a room because you can take everything in this one category and decide on this, you know, area of the room for it. And then you can take the next category and do the same thing. So it makes it easier to make decisions.
Right, definitely. And an important one, toss the guilt. What do you mean, toss the guilt?
The guilt. Wow. The guilt is something that it's kind of like, especially when I'm working with clients, it takes me to say, it's okay you don't love your great-grandmother's china. It's okay that you don't love this end table from your uncle. Because I really, truly believe that a home is your haven. It's the one area in the whole world that's just for you. And when you walk in, you should have good emotions. So if you're hanging on to something from a previous generation and it's making you, you know, you're keeping it out of guilt, it's a negative emotion. It's not worth it. Pass it on to somebody else in the family that'll truly enjoy it. And I really want to say it's okay if you don't love something that your, you know, great aunt loved, because she lived in a different time and maybe you don't have the same taste. It's okay. You shouldn't feel guilty about it. But, you know, we all have it inside of us, and I'm just here to say keep what you love and what you use.
Yeah, and I can so relate to that because I inherited a china cabinet that was my great grandmother's, and my mother, when she lived in America, she brought it over from England. It was housed in San Diego. They all went back to England, and when my aunt died, who was caretaking that cabinet, it was supposed to be shipped up to me in Seattle. Well, it never was, and then I kept getting calls about, when are you coming to pick it up? Well, it's kind of a long way to go to pick up a cabinet that I don't even like or want. And I felt guilty about that for about, I think, 2 or 3 years, until I finally called my one of my girlfriends in San Diego I used to work with and said, can you please do something with it for me?
Right.
Yeah.
You're not alone. Many people get into those situations.
Well, that's why I mention it. And somebody said to me, which really made my mind up. My mother actually told me, you know, let it go. It's not your grandmother. It's not, you have your own memories of her. It's not her. But I think we have that guilt thing. We hold on to it too long.
Exactly. We do. And you know what? The thing is, we need to remind ourselves that the memories are still inside of us. It's not the thing that makes us remember our great-grandmother. You know, the memories in our mind is what does that for us.
Right, right. Another thing you say, this is advice for busy moms to help them stay organized, but it applies to everybody, really. Remember the 80-20 rule of life applies to household stuff, too. So talk a little bit about the 80-20 rule, if you would.
The 80-20 rule, if you haven't already heard about it, is maybe a little surprising. We use 20% of what we own. We maintain, clean, step over, and sometimes, you know, fret about the other 80%.
Right.
What you really want to do is look at the 20% and say, this is great. And you want to try to pare down the other 80%.
The other thing I want to talk about is how we avoid getting overwhelmed, because we can set out with the best of intentions. And I want you to talk a little bit about your book, because it's a little different to most of the organizing books out there. You say in there, I think you go through a weekly process. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, when I was starting to do professional organizing, I was obviously, two people pick up an organizing book, either people that love to organize and wondering if there's anything they're missing, and then other people that want to get organized. And so I was constantly reading organizing books, and there was a lot of great ones out there. But what I kept seeing is that they were lengthy, and they were paragraph after paragraph explaining what to do. And the clients that were hiring me were overwhelmed, and they basically brought me in because they were ready for me to say, you know, to tell them what to do. And it's much like if you want to know how to invest your money, you bring a financial advisor in and say, tell me what to do. So I tried to make the book, first of all, I didn't want to waste anybody's time, because when you're overwhelmed and you feel like you have no time, the last thing you do is pick up an organizing book for pleasure. You would more likely pick up a novel or something you enjoy. So I wanted to keep it straightforward, no fluff, and a step-by-step guide. And what it does is it does week 1 through week 52, and it keeps it very, very straightforward with checklists and tips and things that you can apply to your life now. It's a hardcover spiral bound, so you can leave it open to whatever week you're working on. And I keep the fluff out. I get straight to the point, and I say, this is how you can do it as quickly and efficiently as possible.
Okay, sounds good. Now, I know you said at the beginning of the show that you love to organize, but you weren't always the most organized person. I read somewhere that you were a little like Oscar off The Odd Couple. What was the turning point for you? How did you get to the point where you became more organized?
Well, it's funny because I think I was always organized but didn't realize it. When I finally became honest with myself about where I was going to go with my life after I lost my job, I kept saying, you know, to myself, what am I passionate about? And it was organizing. And when I started being honest, I looked back and I really was good at it and loved it since I was a child. I remember going into my grandmother's house and saying, you know, Grandma, can I organize your jewelry drawer? And I thought it was fun. Mm. What 5-year-old thinks that's fun?
Me.
Yeah. Either you would or you wouldn't.
I used to like to organize her pill bottles, too.
Yeah, I realized it was always there. I just wasn't paying attention.
Right. Well, I want to ask you just before we go, if we decide that we do want to work with a professional organizer, how do we make sure that we get what we want from them? How do we communicate? I'll tell you why, because somebody that I worked with on a project, it was an office project. We brought somebody in to organize some stuff, and nobody could find anything afterwards. So if we have specific needs, how do we make sure we relate those to a professional organizer so that we work in harmony?
Well, I would say anybody that comes into your life and doesn't sit and talk with you first is a big red flag, because they need to know you and your personality and your story, because what works for me might not work for you. And there's no sense, you know, for me to go in and organize your life and your space and walk out and then you don't follow through and you're aggravated and you don't know where things belong and you're not going to follow through, it was pointless. It was a waste of everybody's time and your money. So really, sit down and tell them why you're hiring them and what you expect to get out of this relationship. Mm-hmm. And then the second tip is to normally, I always do the sorting and tossing stage with my client. I think it's, you know, difficult to just leave it to the organizer. Organizers can easily put homes together and all the things you're keeping, they can find homes for that. But the sorting and tossing is very, very personal.
Right. Very personal. Well, I thank you for being with us today. What would you like to leave our listeners with today, Jennifer?
Well, I just want to say to everybody that they can always email me. I love feedback. And then they can go to jenniferforberry.com, which is my blog. And they can also do the Facebook page for the book, which is Organized Now, a week-by-week guide to simplify your space in your life. And they can get, it's a place where you can ask questions, and you can also get support from other people trying to get organized, because we all have our days where we get frustrated, and it's okay. You just need to, you know, somebody to give you a little motivation.
Right. Sounds good. And your website again, your blog is at jenniferfordberry.com, and the website is organizethislife.com, correct?
Right.
Okay. Thank you so much for being with us, Jennifer Fordberry.
Thank you so much, Vicki. It was fun.
Please stay with us. We will be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
To stay another night. You know the score. I wouldn't want you sleeping on the floor. 'Cause living on your own is never any fun. A house is not a home when you make it what you want to.
Hi, I'm Terry with tsigns.com with a quick tip for you. Next time you're crawling through traffic, think of it as promoting your business on the road. Reach potential new clients with custom-designed vehicle graphics, from a classy removable door sign to a full car body wrap, or a simple but effective window decal. We can do it all. We're a family-run business here to help new customers find you. See tsigns.com for a personal guarantee, or call Terry today at 206-971-6800. Again, 206-971-6800.
If you missed a show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
More talk, less rock. Come on, that's a good thing. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Smell, but as far as you can tell, a house becomes hotel when you make it what you want to.
And welcome back, welcome back. My second guest is Dr. Earl Henslin. His new book is called This Is Your Brain in Love, New Scientific Breakthroughs for a More Passionate and Emotionally Healthy Marriage. And Dr. Earl Henslin has a doctorate in clinical psychology. He's a licensed marriage and family therapist, and for the past 14 years has worked very closely with brain imaging research pioneer Dr. Daniel Amen. Dr. Henslin has been integrating brain imaging into the treatment of psychological, physical, and spiritual problems at his counseling practice. He practices out of California, and I talked with him late last week, and here's that interview now. So first of all, Dr. Earl Henslin, I want to welcome you to the show today and say that you've written this new book. It's called This Is Your Brain in Love, New Scientific Breakthroughs for a More Passionate and Emotionally Healthy Marriage. And who doesn't want that, right?
Exactly.
But when we talk about love, we typically refer to the heart. My heart's breaking, it's bursting with joy, I love you with all my heart. But you say in the foreword to your book that the brain is the organ of love and that it's actually the largest sex organ in our bodies. And in this case, this made me laugh, and in this case, size really does matter. Tell us a little bit about that, if you would.
About brain health and brain care, you know, because when you care for your brain and learn to understand it, you know, because if your brain works right, you're going to work right. Relationships are going to go better, work goes better, and everything. And one of the exciting things in the last 14 years has been, I am the staff in my office, we've made over 3,000 referrals for brain scans. And so we've had a chance to integrate this into individual marital counseling, and it has really changed how we do things, because now we can sort out what is a brain chemistry problem, what's a personal issue to work on, and so on. And as so many times the brain's working right, then people will, you know, begin to love more effectively, have better control of anger, better control of anxiety, and so on.
Something that most of us don't really think about, do we, when we're talking about relationships and love and getting on with somebody. You say that a brain in love looks like a brain on cocaine. So tell us a little bit about that, because we often hear that being in love is like being on a drug.
Right. Yeah, well, what happens when we fall in love, there's a neurotransmitter called phenylethylthiamine. And that's at very, very high levels in the brain. It's like the brain is saturated with it. And that same phenylethylthiamine, the acronym is for it, is PE. or pee. That's also the substance in chocolate. You know, that's why people eat chocolate, because it gives that little bit of a boost. And when the brain is saturated with that, then all we can do is, we'll think about the person we're in love with. We can't get them off our mind. We'll, you know, sleep less. In fact, there's even a little bit of an appetite suppressant effect. Many times people, when they're initially in love, they'll lose weight because they just don't feel hungry.
Yeah.
And then that person is just the focus. But then the problem is 6 to 18 months down the road, the brain is saturated and it starts to diminish. And that's when reality sets in. There's been times when doing, like, parents will pay for premarital counseling for their adult children to come in. And they come in, and you can see that kind of dreamy look in their eyes. You know, they're deeply in love and so on. And you can point out to them, well, you know, he hasn't worked the last year and a half. Or, you know, maybe she's got $25,000 in credit card debt or something. And they'll just say, well, we can work it out, you know. And they're in that state. I sometimes think in those situations we need to put them in detox centers on opposite side of the country until they kind of come down to reality. But when it does come down, you know, it doesn't mean people are falling out of love. All it means is that's a time, because there is now a bond and a connection from that whole time of love, to now begin working on a mature love, you know, where you're going to spend a whole lifetime working on. And that's where you learn on communication. You know, for men, there's the thing they're going to do to the last breath on earth is learn how to respond to feelings and to take initiative and being romantic and sensitive and things like that. Things that aren't always natural for men to do. And that is something that couples can grow in together.
Now, there's a saying, love is blind. And I believe that there's a certain amount of truth in that. And is that because of those chemicals?
Well, it's part of the chemicals, yeah, because at that time, you know, we only see the good. And there's something to learn from that, though. Because, you know, like when the brain isn't working, like when we talk about the different types of lovers, you know, there's like the over-focused lover. Well, that person in the initial stages of that whole infatuation and intensity of love, they're going to be very attentive and very focused, a lot of passion and interesting and very thoughtful. And they'll pick up on little details that, you know, just have been missing in a person's life. And that's part of why we just madly fall in love with that person who's that sensitive. But then if that system of the brain isn't working well, then all of a sudden that same person can start to be controlling. Or, you know, you might do 9 good things and there's one thing that didn't get done, and they'll hyper focus on that one thing and they just can't let it go. Or they might have that cingulate area of the brain, it's like a gear shifter, is that obsessive part of the brain. Well, and they'll have trouble forgiving, they'll have trouble letting go. And then we find out if we can balance that kind of area of the brain out, well, then they have an easier time forgiving. They have an easier time letting go. They're more flexible in their thinking. They don't get so black and white. And because all those things are necessary if you're going to be able to maintain intimacy and passion and things like that throughout life.
Right. That's interesting. And you say, you were just talking about the over-focused lover, because you say in the book that our brain chemistry determines the type of lover we are. And you give 5 categories: a scattered lover, over-focused, agitated, anxious, and a blue mood lover. I loved in the book you talked about Frank Sinatra because he's very much associated with matters of the heart. But you say he's one person that you really would have loved to have scanned his brain. Tell us why. Yeah, tell us why Frank Sinatra is one person that you'd really like to have scanned his brain.
When you look at that, here's a guy that, you know, has that incredible capacity to sing and to touch people's hearts and so on. But yet, I also know he had a lot of struggles in his personal life. I was in London one time, and a cabbie was taking me around, and he said, pulled me in and showed me this place. It was a USO during World War II. And he said, and Frank Sinatra came out, and he, and I'm forgetting the name of his wife, were arguing and raging at each other, and she took this diamond ring and just threw it into the bushes. And he went diving in after, and all us blokes just stood there and we cheered for her. But see, there's that other side of him, and that's the side that made it difficult for him to feel intimacy, handle conflict, handle closeness. And I know if he had a chance to look at his brain, life would have been a lot easier for him. Great talent, great gifts, great ability. I mean, we're talking about him today. And an amazing person. But yes, I'd like to look at his brain and so many others. I think we should scan presidents, you know, before, you know, they go into office, or candidates, you know.
Interesting.
And check that out.
So Frank, actually, Frank Sinatra would have fallen into the category of an agitated lover. And you also mentioned actor Charlie Sheen there, because he's been in the news too lately with his issues. If your partner falls into that category, what are some of the steps that you can help deal with some of the anxieties there?
Well, if you have a partner that is an agitated lover, I think one of the things to do is to learn about the brain, you know, and to realize that there's a part of this that is brain chemistry. People really don't want to get that angry, and they don't want to push people away and alienate like that. And so when you start to understand, well, this is a brain chemistry thing, well, then you start to detach a little bit. And if that person is a rager, the best thing in the world to do is just to stop, you know, the conversation. That's worth about $25,000 to $50,000 worth of marital therapy right now. Because when that kind of intensity gets going, then what happens, adrenaline kicks in for both people. And so many times, if you're connected to that agitator lover, your anxiety gets so high, people just kind of freeze, or like a deer in headlights. And so a person needs to, before their anxiety overwhelms, is make themselves safe. You know, just stop the conversation and say, I need to stop for the sake of the relationship, and let's resume talking in an hour. You know, because it actually takes an hour for that burst of adrenaline just to start to calm down. And what you're hoping for is that agitated person will start to process or realize and maybe get in touch with it. Maybe they went too far. And then maybe it'll be that openness or that moment where they'll begin to look at their brain. Because, see, that's one more thing that's been exciting for me as a therapist. In that first year of doing scans, and I keep track of this group of 30 marriages that from that first year. At this point, still 29 out of 30 are still married. And every one of them came in on a point of divorce where and there was one person or both were agitated.
Wow.
And they had that kind of intense anger that would come up. Today we call it verbal abuse, and in some situations domestic violence. And it's almost like a small seizure takes place in the temporal lobes, you know, the sides of the brain right by your ears, behind your ears. And there's a whole family of medications, you know, called mood stabilizers, and some of them are actually anticonvulsants that at low doses will actually give men or women control of anger for the first time in their lives. And that's exciting to see. And none of those people, it ended up being very long-term counseling, you know, because it's in so many situations that the brain is working better. Then there's a lot of the things that they're learning, they're reading about, and life experience starts to kick in and starts to work for them.
Right.
And, I mean, there's always some healing to do. Don't get me wrong. There is a need for counselors and therapists. I am one. But it's amazing to me how this will shorten it if we get the brain chemistry working right.
How do we, is there an easy way for us to determine what our brain chemistry is and which category we'd fall into?
Yes. And, well, the checklist in the book, I actually use those checklists. I've been using them for 14 years. And there, we have some great research. Those clusters of questions, you know, like have to do with the prefrontal cortex, that area right behind the forehead, or the limbic system, that blue mood lover, or the questions connected with that anxiety center in the brain, the basal ganglia. They those symptoms actually and behaviors actually correlate well with research. And so when people come in to see me, they usually might be on some form of medication or supplements or something. They're trying to get things better. But these checklists have been so accurate that so far in the last 14 years, only 100% of the time has there been a need for a medication change or supplement change.
Wow.
And see, and that's because when you understand which area of the brain needs help, then you know how to target medications and or supplements to that specific region of the brain. And this takes the guesswork out of it. And that's been kind of exciting, because not everybody can get a scan, but people can, with these checklists, find out what's working, what's not working.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually helps them even communicate more clearly, say with a counselor or a physician, prescribing physician, or even nutritionist, what's going on, so they get the information they need to be more helpful.
So is there truth then in sex addiction? Because to be quite honest, I've been on that camp that thinks, oh, well, they, you know, it just feels good, it, you know, they enjoy it, and, you know, yeah, let's make up an addiction for it and not take personal responsibility. But is sex addiction a real thing?
Yes, it is. You know, it, and this is going to date me. In about 1976, 1977, I met Dr. Patrick Carnes. I was working at a mental health center in Minnesota, where I'm from originally, and he came and educated our staff on sexual addiction. So I've been dealing with sexual addiction for a long time, and it, to me, it's just as much an addiction as alcoholism and drugs and so on, because one of the criteria for that is as time goes on and progresses, it'll take more extreme behaviors, just like it might take more alcohol or more drugs with those addictions. And if left untreated, can lead to definitely a less quality of life and even death. I mean, those are the stories that don't get told. I've seen a number of people commit suicide as a result of the shame and the guilt and not being able to stop themselves.
Mm.
And when it comes to pornography or sexually acting out and so on. And so when you actually look at the full picture here, you know, like the most public figure right now would be Tiger Woods. And you look at that and the consequences he's experiencing, you know, it, first off, they're normal, and he should be, because that's what's brought him down to a bottom and got him into getting treatment. But you look at this guy engaging in risky behavior, in risky relationships, and so on, and yet continues, and knowing, and when the lust hits, he actually believes he's controlling things, and he's not going to experience the consequences, that somehow it's all going to stay secret. And that's what happens with addiction as time goes on. There's like a spiritual bankruptcy, moral bankruptcy, you know, because you look at the betrayal with his wife and his children and
right.
so on.
Right.
And in a calm state, you know, right now, where he's in the midst of a treatment center, and you ask him, I mean, the guy feels horrible, you know, and he wishes he had stopped years ago, but wasn't able to stop himself. Because I see that all the time. You know, people lose jobs because of internet porn on their computer at work,
wow,
which they should. Yeah. Here they know the consequences, but yet they continue to do it. Now, what we've seen in all these years of working on scans so far, every male or female addict that's come in, we've seen slight injury in the frontal cortex, that area right behind your forehead that has a lot to do with impulse control, forethought, you know, thinking something through before you say it and do it, so you weigh out the consequences. And there's this area in the orbital frontal cortex that has to do with conscience. And so what we find when people get into that addiction, it's like that voice of conscience is now a whisper, and the call of lust is strong.
Interesting.
And so they end up following that.
Yeah, interesting. You share a lot of stories in the book, which I think really help illustrate how the brain does control all of this activity. But I wanted to ask you how platonic friendship suddenly can blossom into love, because you say this type of friendship, when it sets on fire, can often be the most potent and sometimes the most lasting love.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, platonic friendships, you know, because there's that trust that goes with being a friend, you know, and you know, that person that you can count on, you know, will always be there. And when that level level of trust happens, then all of a sudden, boom, that fire of love can get moving. And that can be very, very solid, because now they've got not only passion, but they've got friendship and partnership. And those do last long, long time. And those couples seem to be able to even have a little bit easier time in maintaining that flame of desire because, you know, they have this strong foundation of partnership, friendship.
Right. Now, Al, at the beginning of the show, you said that a brain in love lasts only for about 6 to 18 months, which is kind of depressing.
It doesn't mean it has to die out.
Right. So is there a way that we can, and I know there is because I've seen it in the book, I've seen your recommendations, but how do we keep that fresh? How do we sustain love? How do we rekindle passion?
Well, one of the ways to do that, I think, is to be, you know, very mindful, you know, and what that means to me is the couples that sustain and grow passion are the ones that, and like in Southern California, the insanity of the busyness here, which really is that way all over the country, you know, I have people schedule routine times so that they know they're going to see each other and that those times don't change, and they can count on that. You know, couples should have a minimum of, like, say, a weekend a month or at least a quarter where they're getting away from everything, even children, just to be with each other and to keep that love and that passion alive. You know, today there was I had a talk with somebody on the radio where they had this beautiful ritual that he and his wife had where when they got home, didn't matter what was going on, they sat down, looked each other in the eyes, and just talked about the day. And so every day they had that to look forward to, you know, to see that one person that's going to care about what's going on. And it's the combination of simple things that are hard to do unless you're very mindful. I've even had couples schedule nights are going to make love, because what will happen is in the busyness and the stress of everyday living, you know, that will always get kind of pushed to the side for fatigue and all kinds of reasons. But if it's there, then all of a sudden you got people looking forward to that, anticipating, and they're also treating each other in such a way that that's going to be a wonderful time. And see, men don't understand how serious of a healthcare issue this is. I mean, because love and passion, really, the way we're wired, it's for our well-being. There's a study in Wales where of 1,000 men over a five-year period of time, and they found out that those men that made love 2 times a week or more, their mortality rates from heart attacks dropped 50%.
Wow, that's considerable.
There is no cardiovascular program out there at that success rate. Now, can you imagine the public service announcements for the American Heart Association? It's not an apple a day. It keeps the doctor away. You know? And for women, what makes for long life is the quality of the sexual experience. So lousy lovemaking, women won't live as long. And so that also means women have to be direct and clear-cut, because men don't get, you know, subtlety so much, just the way their brain is wired, about what's pleasing, not pleasing, and so on, and not hesitate in that. And so, you know, this is actually health care. You know, what's good for the heart is good for the brain. What's good for the brain is good for the heart.
Sounds good to me.
I have one good friend. He said to me, after going through a divorce, and I was telling him this research, he said to me, "Now, Earl, if I die of a heart attack, I want my first wife charged with murder." Of course, I had to point out to him, I said, "Well, you know, we have to hear her side of this before the sentence." Didn't really appreciate me saying
it. Well, that's a good note to end our segment on. What would you like to leave our listeners with? This is a great book. I really learned a lot about the brain and how it works. There's even a whole segment at the back called New Hope, Women and Hormones, which we haven't even had a chance to touch on.
Yeah.
What would you like to leave our listeners with, Earl?
Well, what I'd like to leave people with is learn about, I know this is a whole new way of looking things, but learn about brain health. You know, we get one brain and we want it to last and work well over a lifetime. Because when your brain works right, you work right. You're going to be a better lover, you're going to be better at work, you're going to be a better parent, grandparent, and so on.
Sounds good. And listeners can find out more about you. I think your website is drhenslin.com. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And I even have a Twitter username as Dr. Henslin.
Okay. And that's DrHenslin. And Dr. Henslin's new book is called This Is Your Brain in Love, New Scientific Breakthroughs for a More Passionate and Emotionally Healthy Marriage. Dr. Earl Henslin, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you. It's been fun.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. Thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate you spending this hour with us on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. I'll be back in the studio with you next week, Monday at noon, for an all-new live show. If you have comments, feedback, questions on today's show, you can reach me at 800-495-7617. That's our toll-free number. It's 800-495-7617. Or you can always drop me an email at info@conversationslive.net. And our website, of course, is conversationslive.net. Okay, so we're done for today. We'll see you next week. Until then, live well, live strong, and thanks for being with us.
What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa.
February 22nd on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, a day in the life of Oscar the Cat. Dr. David Dosa was more than skeptical when he first heard about the resident cat at a nursing home, the cat who regularly predicted a patient's imminent death by snuggling up to them during their last few hours. What does Dr. Dosa think now? Is Oscar the cat a furry little grim reaper or a comfort to caregivers and patients? Join us Monday the 22nd to find out on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for hundreds of past interviews.
What's new, pussycat?